Hello everyone, welcome to the Talking Split podcast again. I am Rob Calder, coming to you with a little message before this week's podcast. Unfortunately, we did have a little bit of an audio glitch when we recorded this podcast a few weeks ago. The podcast itself is with Kelsey Griffin, and Kelsey is just a legend of a person, but also a fantastic resource for a lot of people out there too. So when we got the audio back on this one, we were devastated with how it sounded. It doesn't sound like it should. We've put it through all sorts of programs to try and fix it, rectify it, make it a little bit cleaner with how it sounds, all those types of things. This is as good as we managed to get it. It sounds like probably a bad Zoom recording, if that, I don't know if that helps you or hurts you a little bit as you're going to listen to this one. But there was just too much good stuff in here from Kelsey. Kelsey is just a legend of basketball in general. And, you know, we wanted to make sure that we, one, didn't waste her time, but also didn't keep this resource that we could be using for coaches out there as well. So I do apologize, firstly, to Kelsey for the audio quality. It's not where it usually would be. So apologies to her, but apologies to any coaches that do find this one a little bit of a harder hear than they normally would. It's still definitely worth a listen. Kelsey is amazing and would strongly recommend that anybody tune in for this one because Kelsey is fantastic.
This is the Talking Split Podcast.
Welcome, coaches, to the Talking Split Podcast. I am Rob Calder. As always, with me, Zoe Carr, as mostly always. Every now and again, we sub you out for other people. Every now and again, I get it right, but regularly get it wrong. And very rarely do we have a multiple appearing guest on the show, which is usually their choice and not ours necessarily. Super fortunate to have four-time WNBL champion, three-time WNBL Grand Final MVP, WNBL MVP, WNBL Defensive Player of the Year, WNBA Athlete, Opal, playing number retired in college. I'm running out of breath as I'm going through this. And more importantly, one of the players that Zoe has mentioned multiple times she loves being around in general, Kelsey Griffin.
Oh, wow. Welcome. That is an intro. Do we even need to talk?
We don't have long left, it turns out. But, I mean, it's an incredible career you've had and continue to have to this point. So we are very, very grateful for you coming in on the podcast in particular. This is the end of your season. You've unfortunately haven't made playoffs and those types of things. But what does an off-season look like for you now?
It's definitely changed throughout my career. So unfortunately this season I did get injured. I ended up rupturing my hamstring, which we believe may have been caused by an underlying knee issue, which I had to get addressed after the season. So, just about 3 weeks post-op. And so a lot of my energy this off season will be into putting into my body and getting ready for next season, but also trying to fill up my cup. So hopefully a lot of mountain biking as well. But
it's going to be good for the hamstring, surely. Like it's all part of the rehab side of things. Like it's, I mean, it's a tough thing to go through, injuries in particular. Like, are you a good injured person or are you just a really difficult injured person to be around?
It depends on who you ask. I think I'm all right, but if you ask my wife, she might say it's different. I think this is surgery number 10. And I'd always promised myself if I got to double digits, I'd retire. But after the season, I just came off of, I feel like I've still got a lot of basketball left to play. So feeling a bit, I guess, reinvigorated and really excited about what SEN and Bendigo are doing and what they want to build as far as what women's basketball looks like, not only in Country Victoria, but also in the WNBL. So I think that's kind of given me a fresh start on this chapter of my career and was part of the reason of coming back. So I think that'll be an underlying motivation. But whilst I used to play in the offseason, I used to think, getting a lot of reps and staying in touch used to be a really important thing. What I'm finding now is refreshing and what that looks like and making sure that I'm mentally prepared to enter a season as much as it is physically.
Has it always been that way? Like back in like the college and high school days, et cetera, have you always been a grind through an off-season type thing or have you needed time away from the sport?
So I was, most coaches will probably be shocked to hear, I was never a gym rat. So I was somebody that when I trained really hard. And then when I was away, I was away, much to my college coach's disappointment, I think. She would always leave, always after the season, she'd be like, a year older doesn't mean a year better, Kelsey. And I'm like, yeah, I gotcha, but I'm going back to Alaska. But actually it was my first real injury that made me have to stay in an off season at Nebraska and rehab. And that's really what kind of changed, I think, the trajectory of my career. And then once I was playing in the WNBA, there wasn't really off season. So WNBA was in the summers and Europe was in the winters. And then for the start of my WNBL career, I was still WNBA, WNBL. And then the Spirit were in this really interesting transition point where they're wanting to do more work in regional Victoria, and I saw an opportunity that the club to partner with me, and instead of going back to the WNBA, I'd say that I can do stuff in regional golf and really love doing that. And so that's probably when my off season started to change. I never really had the ambition to play in CBL at the time or NBL one. And so I really used that time to refresh and be away from sport. But then I think it was only the next year I became an Australian citizen, and then I started having Opals commitments. Got to have Opals commitments, I should say. And that kind of became my carrot, why I wanted to play. So I guess it's kind of been an ebbs and flows of what, but if I was saying what my perfect offseason would look like, it'd be a lot less basketball and a lot more life.
Yep, that makes a lot of sense. It's, I mean, you touch on the Opal stuff there. Is it the sort of thing that you ever walk away from? Like, if the phone was to ring tomorrow, argument's sake, and they said, hey, are you interested? Is it the sort of thing you'd say, yeah, I'm in for, or is it sort of, no, I'm good with it now?
You said you weren't going to ask any hard-hitting questions.
Yeah, I apologize.
It's like, first can I be in? Yeah. Such a good question. My journey with the Opals, and I don't actually know how many Opals would feel about their journey, but mine was one where I was probably at a point of retiring. I wasn't really sure where I wanted to be or what I wanted to do with basketball yet. In my first Opals camp over in Phoenix, I had an absolute blast. I was coming off a hamstring surgery, really thinking that I was done, and I'd done a 5-week all-intensive rehab up at the AIS and realized what an incredible facility that could be. I had this ARC program that involved a physio and S&C coach, basketball coach, sports psych, biomechanics, like all of it was done recovery. I was like, wow, this is professionalism of women's sport. And that led me into my Opals camp, where I was getting challenged with concepts, learning about how ball screen defenses could be defended for different actions and rotations. And basically it was a huge growth of like, wow, there's this whole bit of basketball that I haven't really thought of. And so it was really nice and challenging. And I was like, this is why I want to play basketball, to be an Opal. And then I got to represent Australia at the Asia Cup. And so whilst camp was amazing, then actually getting to put on the green and gold, it's hard to even describe. And people ask me, because I'm naturalized, like what it meant. And for me, it's almost, I shouldn't say more significant, because I don't know what it would be like if I was Australian, as in born Australian, but it's almost, it was a decision that I chose to represent Australia, and for that to be the nation that I put on my chest. And so for me, that was a really big moment and a pivotal moment in my career. And that really shifted all of my ambition, which you should never do, put all your eggs in one basket, to making Opals. And my journey was an interesting one because it was all about this naturalized spot. So me, Sammy Whitcomb, and Leilani all play very different positions. You can make an argument Sammy's a combo guard, which she's shown at Worlds. But I'm not even close to it. Would never want to put my hand up to be an office point guard. It's probably the most difficult, I would say, basketball position that you can play in this country. And so my journey, being an Opal, came about being, I had to show that I was more beneficial to the team, not only in my individual position, that I had to be better than anyone in that position, but also that what I brought was more outstanding than even a point guard when there was lack of depth in that spot. So a lot of it was out of my control. So he's probably come to know that I'm a control freak. So
in a good way. In a good way.
So for me, became my journey soon with the Opals became one of disappointment and beating my head against a brick wall. And that was because I had very little control, in my opinion, about my situation, my outcome. And so I put everything I could to put myself in a position to be as competitive as possible for that spot. And I think when I missed out on Worlds in 2018, I had re-torn my hamstring because I chose not to go play WNBA and chose to stay and help in the China prep tournament for Worlds. Ended up redoing my hamstring. And then, say unfortunately, but maybe fortunately, missed selection. My way of dealing and grieving and processing, which I didn't realize I was grieving at the time, was to just show everybody how great I was. And that fueled what was my Canberra Capitalist career. But it's something I talk about now with teammates that I can reflect on and realize how much pain I was going through. Couldn't verbalize that at the time. But whilst there was a lot of really good memories, and I'm really and have some of my best friendships from that time, it wasn't necessarily a time of joy and happiness and appreciating the journey. It was all fueled about, I'll show you. And
Yeah, I don't suggest it. So opals obviously became a big part of motivation for you. Then obviously a bit of a I'm going to show you became a part of your motivation. And then obviously in this stage of your career, what motivates you now? What is the – because for those that may not know, KG is one of the most professional athletes I've had the privilege to be able to work with and be involved with. And, you know, as Rob said earlier before we started the pod, you know, I'll be driving home from Bendigo nearly falling asleep or something like that, and he's like, oh, how are you going? I'm like – and you always come up because there's always something. There's always something.
Positively.
There's always just some nugget of gold that comes out. So, you know, if that part, with that part of your life sort of being behind you, what motivates you now to still have that, you know, utmost level of professionalism and drive and motivation for everybody else? Well, thank you. That's very kind of you. So I guess to answer your questions, I didn't answer it. No. I would probably decline, I don't think my heart would be in it in the same way. I think I could perform and I think I could contribute, but I think that I've worked really hard to get past, to grieve, to mourn, which I don't think athletes are taught enough about. It's actually a grieving process with Miss Selection, the Miss Teams that you go through. So I had to get some education for myself on that. So because I've done so much self-work to get through that, I don't think I could open up those old scars. But as much as it is a massive honor and still one of the highlights of my career getting to play at the Asia Cup.
MVP of the tournament, incidentally. Like, I don't want to shortchange you on anything. I didn't have enough room to roll that one in.
So, yes, my career now. So after the Hub season, I really thought I was going to retire again. It was really tough. I was coming off some – probably didn't realize the mental burnout I'd had off of the rehabs that I had to go through. And I think in large part, I was going like something like 4 or 5 surgeries in 3 years. Like, it had been a lot. And I think that's, I've probably overdoing it a bit, trying to make my push for the opals in hindsight. And so when Keely, Foley asked if I wanted to play Launceston in MBL1, I was kind of like, no, I don't really think so. But, getting to go and play with her and have all the responsibility be her, and I just get to be that import again and show up, play games, get to go home and not deal with anything, really showed me that I still have a lot of joy and have a lot of fun playing basketball, and I know it won't last forever. And so that made me want to sign up for last season or 2 seasons ago in WNBL. And then I knew that my time with the Caps was probably coming to an end. Gauze had moved on, and there's going to be some big changes. And I thought, you know, is it my time to retire? You know, am I done? Is it time to start this next chapter? Or is it time to go somewhere else and to see what else is out there and what else I can do? And all these discussions and decisions happen with my wife, Erin. She's my sounding board, and it's a joint decision because it affects her a lot. And so when Kennedy got the job at Bendigo and there was new ownership, Erin and I started talking about what could be and what I had hoped Bendigo would be 5 years ago when I left. And when I left, I was fighting more for club survival and pathways than I was for playing on the court. So I felt like much of my job, my last few years in Bendigo, was about keeping the club afloat, finding sponsorship, learned a lot about the WNBL and about how clubs operate, but so little of it was about playing. That was my move to Canberra and move to be an Opal and move to want to push basketball as far as I could. So now that I realize my legacy is pretty much set, there's not really a lot I could do. I couldn't find more championships, and I don't think anyone would change how they view or think about me or think about my career. So when I decided to come back to Bendigo, it was about helping create a club in regional Victoria that I had always... It was always foreign to me because Bendigo, when I found Bendigo in 2012, it was pivotal in my life. And so for me, coming back to Bendigo is just as much about, I guess, hopefully it's ascendancy in the WNBL and becoming a championship contending team and hopefully winning a championship, but it was more about building the foundation of what I always thought the club could be. So that now is my motivating piece, and also trying to upskill and teach as many people around me the things that have helped me to be successful.
Sounds like she's close to transitioning into coaching.
You keep planting that seed. Just throwing it out.
Get that completely. Why wouldn't you? Like, is it, and then, look, I mean, credit to you, because you are the sort of person that has done the work over the years where you're in a position now where people call you to play for them, not the other way around. And, like, a lot of players have gone through that process where they have to make that first step of saying, look, I'm interested in playing for you. Is this going to work out? Whereas now people call you. How do you filter out, like, I don't want to say the good coaches from the bad coaches, but how do you work out who you actually want to play for? Because you are in a position where you're not trying to prove anything. Like, as you said, your legacy is very, very well established within Australian basketball for sure. How do you work that out?
So this is great. If you'll bear with me, I've got another story to share. I think this is how I know I'm getting old. Story time. So free agency happened, and I've always thought I would play for Shannon Seabon. And I really appreciate him as a coach. I appreciate his X's and O's. From an outsider looking in, I've never played for him. But, you know, we've never had a conversation. But when I give my keys to the game, when I'm commentating a game, it's like pretty bang on what his keys to his game are. And so I think that we have a lot of similarities in how we view the game. And I think that that would have been a pretty seamless transition. And really believe they would be competing for a championship this season. And so we spoke, and he was really keen to have me up in Townsville and offered me a great contract. Accommodating Aaron, our animals, would have made the move very, very easy. Basically ticked every single box a player could ever want for, especially at this phase in my career. And then I spoke with Kennedy. And our conversations were obviously about me as a player and wanting to play, but it was also about building something pretty special. And I, in my gut, knew that if I went to Townsville, I would probably be competing for a championship. And in Bendigo, I was signing up for unknown. I had absolutely no idea what it would be like. And that was stressful. And I wasn't sure. I'm, like I said, control freak. I like to know what I'm going into. I like to have plans. I like to have backup plans. And there was really nothing that could be planned for. But for me, it was more about what unfinished business in Bendigo and wanting to move there. So when I'm looking at a coach, for me now, a coach is a huge part of the piece, but it's not all of the piece. It's also, I need to know my carrot. I need to know why I'm there, what I'm working for. And at this point in my career, basketball is a portion of it, but I know that it can't be the only thing that I have in my life as well. So it was the most, I don't know, I guess anticlimactic conversation with Shannon, because I said, you've literally given me everything I could ever want. You ticked every box, but I'm sorry. And there's nothing else you could have done. It was like the worst breakup. Absolutely nothing to do with you and everything to do with me. And I don't know why I'm doing it. I didn't know why I was doing it. But I think for me, I've been pretty, I say fortunate, but I've also worked really hard, I think, to have the respect and the understanding and the education and my basketball knowledge to be able to work closely with coaches. But I think that's the biggest thing for me, that I need a coach who's very sure of themselves, knows their system, knows what they want, but is still willing to collaborate, talk, help me with the process, help me understand the process. And I think that relationship building is just so key.
Yeah. Is that what you were early in your career as well? Or has that just been developed over time?
Definitely developed over time. I think my biggest, like, I really struggled to transition to being a pro. Like people say your freshman year of college is tough. Like, mine was tough, but certainly my first 3 years pro were horrific. Hardest points in my professional or my basketball journey for sure. And I think it's because I didn't have the IQ, because in college I was a great robot. Like, I hate being yelled at. And so if you told me not to do something or you told my teammate not to, I wasn't going to do it. So I think, you know, like, that was a coach's dream from that standpoint. But I didn't understand the game coming out of college. And to be a great pro, you need to understand the game. And so I think for me, that was probably the biggest hurdle. And so my struggles, whilst it was also that there were huge holes in my game, a lot of my struggles came with not actually understanding the game of basketball.
Well, and as the game's changed as well over the time, you know, when you probably started in college, you know, it was very system based. It was A to B, B to C, C to D. And the game has evolved over that time to now it's decision making based. So, you know, we hear a lot of coaches often getting really angry about, you know, poor decision making and lack of IQ, and they're just, you know, they're not as smart as they used to be and all that sort of stuff. And it's the style of play has changed into there's a heavier emphasis on decision making now. So before it was, there's, you catch the ball here, there might be this cut or this cut. So you knew where you had to look. Whereas now that's obviously changed. And I think that'd be really difficult. Have you found that difficult sort of transitioning through with the evolution of the game?
I think because I did it in Australia, like I made a conscious decision to stay in Australia to invest in my basketball. So like after my first year here, I got offered contracts in Turkey that were 3-4 times what I was going to make here. But I knew that my game still had massive gaps in it. So my initial plan was always to stay here, invest in myself, and use this as a way to continue to get better before I was ready to go back to Europe. But I never left. Australia should come with,
quite thankful for it.
Australia should come with a warning label. You will find your partner and you will never leave. But I think because I was, I guess, got to play with really highly intelligent basketball players from the get-go, I got to be the person that looks good because of the people around me, and then eventually was able to develop into somebody that could help others look better is what I'm hoping to do now in my career. But that kind of came with ebbs and flows and different coaches and different teammates. And, you know, sometimes you learn more from systems or coaches that you clash with than you actually do from coaches that you see eye to eye with. And I think that's been part of my journey as well, with playing with lots of different coaches and, you know, having absence of them or being able to reflect back on it. Like my college coach, I hated her. Like I absolutely hated her. I thought she didn't understand me. I thought she was mean. I thought she was too critical. I thought she couldn't see how hard I was working and everything I was doing. And then 5 years later, I realized I am so grateful for everything she did for me and sacrificed me liking her for me to get to be the best player that I could be. But it took me 5 years and playing for different coaches to actually see that and have that space.
Yeah. And is it for coaches that are listening, that's a balance, right? Like that can't just be, you know, I think one of the worst things for basketball was the movie Coach Carter, because everybody started just putting people on the line and making them run and all this sort of stuff.
Teaching you accountability.
But without the understanding of what that situation was and how important, you know, every situation is different. But it's a balance, and you see sometimes people fall into the, I need to be this super critical sort of, you know, hard coach, but there's no substance behind why. And that's where you start to lose players. And that's where, you know, particularly young female players, they start to walk away from the game and things like that. Whereas if you can strike that balance of, no, I'm not being critical of you, I'm holding you accountable to the standards that you want. And it comes down to knowing your players, though. She probably knew you far more than you realize.
Absolutely. And I think, like, I allowed it. Like, she would yell at me and I would push harder. that's the thing. Like, she knew that, like, she could keep demanding more and I had more to give. Like, I think that's the thing, and to that, you know, and I didn't love basketball. Like I wasn't really, and I think, you know, I look back on my journey and I didn't have goals to be a Div 1 player. Like I didn't have goals to play in the WNBA. I didn't have goals to represent a country. Like I didn't have these goals. So like I was literally being guided by the people in these positions of power to help mold me along my journey, which I think looking back, I'm really fortunate to have put myself in those positions where I had people that really could push me to be that. But it also allowed, I guess, myself to have a bit more grace, because it wasn't until I was drafted 3rd overall that I felt like I was underachieving, because I really didn't have a standard as such that I was holding myself to, if that makes sense. So I think my journey was probably a little bit different because of that. But yeah, my coach certainly knew the buttons to push. But I think for me, when I look back, would I do college again? Absolutely not. But I am so glad I did, because I am infinitely confident. And I don't mean that in like a cockiness or in my abilities. It's more in what I can push myself through. And so I think that she gave me a gift that no one else could possibly do, because no matter the situation in life or circumstance in life or on the court, I know how tough I am. And I think no one can just tell you how tough you are. I think it's something you have to experience. And so I'm really grateful for that. But it did take me a long time.
It's interesting when you talk about the dynamic with coaches in particular. There was, I don't want to say there was a narrative around it, but there was always this feeling that you should be more of a three than a four.
Yes.
Like, as a player. And I think it was height related. Like, yes. I think people just looked at it and thought, oh, yeah, maybe just a little bit too small for a four. Clearly not the case. How do you deal with that? But like, does that impact on your confidence as a player, where you sort of feel like I'm not doing the right thing because people are now trying to move me into a position that's not natural for me? Like, how do you deal with that?
That's a really good question, and probably something I haven't really thought of lately, but certainly, actually, I think my coaches in college actually recruited me to be a three, and I remember us doing breakdown drills in preseason, and I got shifted from the three basket to the four basket, and then eventually was in the five basket. So I actually spent most of my college career as a center, which is kind of in the Pac-12, I mean, sorry, in the Big 12, nonetheless. So it's actually kind of crazy. And, you know, there was rules where, you know, I didn't really shoot outside the key, and it was about pounding it inside, and that was my job. And then got drafted and kind of developed a perimeter game, but not really. And then got drafted as a three. And so in the best league in the world, I was playing out of position, and let me tell you, coming off a ball screen versus setting a ball screen, very different skill set. Going over a ball screen on defense versus hard hedging, very different skill set. So I think that's probably when my confidence was shaken the most. And like, at that time, threes were really a big part of floor spacing, holding the corners. So being a really great knockdown 3-point shooter from the corner and different things like that. And it was very systematic, the first system that I was drafted into. And so I think that's probably where I was shook the most, and probably also hurt that confidence in that transition in my first 3 years. And then played in the four at Bendigo. Me and Chelsea Obrey would actually cross match. So I would play in the four offensively, and I would defend the three defensively. And because she was a better 3-point shooter, she would play the three offensively, and I'd get to play the four. And so it worked really well for us. And then it wasn't until Chalk was the Opals coach and went to the first camp, and he was pretty adamant that I needed to be a three at the international level because of my height. And I had a lot of skill deficiencies in the three, have my most of my career. And so it's really only been something that's been brought up when it comes to international and WNBA. But for Australia, even though the leagues, I think, fluctuated from sometimes the league's really big and sometimes the league's a bit smaller, for the most part, I've been able to hold my own. And I think people are surprised, some of the people that are taller than me, when I'm standing next to them off the court, that they're like, oh, I didn't realize you were shorter than them. So I joke and I say I play big, but yeah, I don't know. I guess you'd have to ask my opponents.
True. But it's a skill set thing, but it's an IQ thing too. Yeah. Like, if you're smart enough, you can play multiple positions anyway. You know where to maybe cheat on something to be able to not get posted up or what, like those types of things. Like, I think it's a lot of our junior athletes, and I suppose a lot of our junior coaches too, pigeonhole kids into you are this position and this is what you have to be, and they never sort of get to experience anything else outside of that. And like listening to you there, it's like, well, I'm just going to lean in and be the best version of what I can be in a position that's comfortable for me. And it's held you pretty well.
Yeah, and it is a tricky one, because you do see these juniors that, you know, and development happens at different rates and all of that. So you do see these kind of like 5'10", 5'11", 6-foot dominant junior post players that would really have to be able to do something special to potentially play at this. Now I'm 6'2", well, maybe 6'1".
She's on. Yeah. I thought you were 6'3", so roll with it.
But so I understand, like, if you're a junior coach and you're trying to give this junior their best chance at making it at the next level, you know, pushing them into these, trying to fit them into these spots that maybe or maybe they aren't at the time. And I think part of it for me, I would just encourage, is exposure. So I think, like, my transition to the three probably would have been a lot easier if in college I had been exposed. I was playing the four, and that's what my team needed. Having exposure at reps at three, breakdown drills, where there is points in off season for individual improvement, where it's not performance based, you know, exposing kids to these skills, teaching them the game, teaching them the reads. Because I think so much of guard play now is about understanding help side defense as much as the initial action that they're actually, you know, so all those kind of things. Because, you know, you see a lot of different body types in the guard positions that can do some incredible things that aren't quick, that aren't athletic, but it's because of their IQ and what they can control. So I would just encourage exposure. I don't know if I would have ever been a great three, but I think if I had been exposed to it earlier, it would have given me a better chance. And it's, I think you've hit the nail on the head, because sometimes when coaches, and I've done this earlier in my coaching journey, where, you know, I've identified this athlete and I think, you know, if you could just slide into the three, or, you know, slide down the line a little bit, you know, that could open up so many more doors for you. So I put them exclusively in that position and they see no success. And so, you know, it's got to be a, you know, if you're an undersized four, for example, okay, you're starting the game in that. Now I'm going to find pockets for you to swing you into the three, to give you that exposure. But ultimately, I'm going to keep putting you back into the four so you can get back into where you're comfortable. So you're not, because you just think about it. Imagine being sort of almost out on that island a little bit for 40 minutes, you know, and you're trying to contribute, you're trying to do everything that you're told, but you don't have the skill set yet, and you're left there for the whole game. So I think one of the really important things is just sort of finding those pockets in games and in practice as well, but just sliding them back into where they're comfortable so they can see that success, keep that confidence, and keep the love for the game, really, because, you know, that's when things start to go wrong consistently, is when people, and again, I say it a lot on this pod, particularly young female athletes, start to find other interests and move away from the game, which is obviously what we're trying to avoid.
Yeah, and I think, like, just listening to you talk about that, I think that's exactly right. I think for me too, a couple of things, like when you're asking an athlete to get outside their comfort zone, being really clear about what success looks like. So like, if it is minutes at the three, or if it is in a drill where they're not going to be as dominant as they would be at the four, you know, is it that they held space really well? Is it that, you know, they'd stopped there? You know, there's this whole other half of the game that sometimes you forget about where they actually did a really great job defending the three, you know, like, wow, you know, like, yeah, maybe you're not a great creator, but man, you can defend, you're versatile, you know, like, so I think that's helping as a player, if you're not clear about what success looks like in a position because you don't know that position, I think for a coach to be able to validate what success looks like would also be really helpful and be reassuring, so that athlete's not trying to seek out or make up their own idea of what success looks like.
Yeah, 100%. I think sometimes we get caught, especially in the midst of competition, of, you know, okay, I want you to play in the three, so we throw them out on that island, and then it's not working, so now I'm getting angry, and now I'm, you know, and they're trying their best.
Yep.
And it's really important, you know, again, we talk on the pod a fair bit about consistency in coaching, yeah, and consistency in messaging. If you're going to throw them out there, you have to be as comfortable with the chaos, yeah, of the, you know, what might come of it when it's not quite working, as excited as you would be when they do finally, that click happens and you start to see actually play out for you on the floor.
For sure. And I think, like, because if we don't let them know, well, we're going to compare. So, like, for me in the WNBA, I didn't know what success looked like, because I couldn't have even named more than three teams in the WNBA when I got drafted. So, like, I was just completely oblivious. So then I started looking at benchmarks and I said, okay, well, who else has been drafted number three? Okay, Tamika Catchings. Right, okay, I need to be like her.
That's a good start.
Oh, Diana Schroff. Diana Schroff. Okay. So these are what top three players, you know, and they're 4 years ahead of me. So they're starting their prime. And I'm like, okay, well, why am I here? Because I'm nothing like them. I can't play. You know, and so that's kind of, you know, I think having real clarity around the stepping points. And then the other thing I would encourage athletes and players out there to do is, if you're just relying on your talent, you're replaceable, right? Like, so if you're, unless you're like a Breanna Stewart, even her, I would argue that she has other attributes, whether it's in the locker room, whether it's as a teammate, whether it's in the community, like that. If you're just relying on your ability to play basketball, you're actually quite replaceable, because there's enough people playing basketball. And so I think that's one thing, like, why coaches ask me to come to their team, I would say, has not very little, but a lot less to do with my basketball than it does to do with what the other things that I can bring to the team. So whilst you're also transitioning, if you're transitioning between positions, and that, as a player, gain a lot of confidence about the other things that you bring to the team besides just offensive production, because I think that's probably where most players and coaches will get tied up within that.
without a doubt. Are you someone that seeks out a lot of positive feedback or constructive feedback? What I suppose resonates with you the most? Because everyone's a little bit different. There are some that sort of need orders barked at them and that will get them going. There are others that sit there and say, look, I need to feel really good about myself before I can perform. What drives you in that space?
That's such a good question.
All right, Kelsey. Every now and then, that's a good question. I get nothing from you and Coots.
We give you donuts, yeah. At times in my career, I've worried that I've lost my competitive edge, but I'm still very much a competitive person. So what I've loved about this last season with the Spirit is how Kennedy makes almost everything, if not everything, competitive. So I thrive in an environment where I get to compete. And I think I hate losing more than I like winning. I actually think I hate losing more than I like winning. So, because I can play it down like, oh yeah, you know, good session, blah, blah, blah. But if I hate losing, like, I sit and I stew on it. Like, I don't think about it anymore, you know, but if I lose a scrimmage at training, like, I stew on it. Aaron can tell you, I stew on it and that kind of stuff. So, I love a challenge. I love being challenged. And it's something I've probably struggled with more in my career. And, cause coaches probably lean on me more for help, and expect that maybe assume that I have all the answers. And it's because they have so much respect for me, which I really do appreciate. But the amount of times I've been coached probably in the last, you know, a few years of my career has diminished compared to. But now I say that if a coach was to really go at me like they might a younger development player, maybe my tune would change. Maybe it's been so long that, you know, like I have the longest leash, you know, like I get to make the most mistakes. Like I've earned that, and I bring a lot to be able to have that. But I think that I do at times miss that being coached, miss being told, you know, like, you did this, next time do this, or I know that you saw that, but really what we need is this. And I think it's because I'm fortunate to have so much trust from my coaches that sometimes gets lost. So I've thought at times, you know, maybe it is time for me to retire because I'm not getting really like pushed in a sense of being coached to that level that sometimes my teammates are. But then what was so great about this season was that I learned an entirely new system. I was shooting more threes than twos for most of the games. It was completely different to anything I had done. So I was being stretched and pulled, and it was so challenging. But it was really, whilst it was exhausting, it was really what I needed to stay hungry and motivated to play. And so I think for me, at different points in my career, I've needed different things depending on where my own insecurities and confidence lies. But I have such a great family that is always worried about how I'm doing, not how I'm performing, that's my safety net. And so I get a lot of my, we'll call it feel goods, from my family. My wife in particular, but my parents as well, and my best friend, that's kind of my fallback. So like, from an emotional standpoint. So then coaches, I think, can be more critical on me because I don't have my parents or my partner or my friends being critical of me. So I think I'm really lucky to have that good balance. And I'm also 35 and quite confident in who I am as a person and player. So it's a bit different and harder, I suppose, harder to say, but I think that's when I look back. Why I've been able to have the career I have is because of how I was loved by my family throughout this really difficult journey at times.
It's a phenomenal answer for a start, because it was a great question. No,
but it's one of those things too that athletes need to understand, you know, especially as you start to get up into pro levels. It's the old saying, right? Everyone's not treated equally, but everyone is treated fairly. So, you know, your leash is going to be longer than a first year, you know, pro. And you've, like you said, you've earned that. And I think sometimes athletes can get caught thinking that, you know, they should be treated like, you know, the 400 game vet.
Yeah, they compare more.
Yeah, like, and it's like, no, there's been a bit more going to that athlete. There's been a lot more learning, a lot more experience, all those sort of things.
Output.
And sometimes, you know, we talk about do your time, and in that sort of instance, you have to do your time. You've got to do your time to earn that, not so much respect because you are respected, but earn that trust
and that, you know, that longer leash. The more you earn it, the harder you work, the longer that leash becomes. And I think sometimes the athletes now get a little bit, you know, I want that leash to be, you know, 90 foot long yesterday. And it's just not the way. And I think it's from a coaching perspective, you know, that's something we've got a responsibility of sort of driving into our athletes as early as possible of, you know, things don't just fall in your lap, you know, whilst it might look like that because, you know, someone might get picked in a state team or they might get a development role with a WNBL or an NBL team or something like that. You have no idea what work's going on behind closed doors for that athlete to get there. So I think it's really important that as coaches, we're delivering that message and we're consistent with our actions as well, because it's harder at the junior level. The junior level, a kid could put no work in, but they are 6'3" at 11. And, you know, and so now you get to play the majority of the minutes and you've got this other kid who's working their butt off at everything and doesn't play as much because, you know, they're 5'4" or whatever that might be. So I think as coaches, we've got to start really delivering that message. And sometimes we need to be a little bit more brave as to how we show that the amount of work, if you want that leash to be longer, more work's got to go into it. And you can't just rely, like you said before, you can't just rely on, you know, either natural gifts or abilities.
And it's something that, like, I've had to have some really, I think my third season in the WNBA was probably one of my most pivotal ones because I played sometimes, like, I played the least amount. Our team was the most successful. And it was when I truly got to understand what being a bench player was, because I hadn't been a bench player really throughout my whole career. And I was a starter my rookie season, came off the bench, and then essentially by my third season, barely played unless there was injuries and I needed to play big minutes. But it was also one of my most favorite seasons in the WNBA because my role was so clear. And I got to really understand, I think, team dynamics from that point and really gained a lot of empathy about what it was like to be that bench player. And I think it really helps me to understand now how my teammates feel. But I share that because rarely on teams is it 12 of the best players, right? Even starting fives, I would argue, shouldn't be your five best players. It's your five players that get you the best start. And then who finishes the game could be different depending on how the game goes out. And so I think also at the junior level, if we can start to educate players on there being so much more besides just production, especially in this day and age. Like Dame Lillard just had a great talk with JJ Redick, if you're allowed to talk about podcasts on podcasts. No, that's okay.
As long as it's not like a New South Wales podcast. No.
About, I mean, and I'm biased because I am a vet, but about vet presence, but also about like this individual focus at the moment, you know, like highlighting triple doubles and losses and highlighting, you know, 50 points, whatever it was, you know, and Dame really weathered the storm in Portland as far as being so sure about what his journey in Portland's going to be like and chasing championships and all of this kind of stuff. And it was just, I just really appreciate it. I haven't listened to the whole thing, but I just, particularly now for juniors where you can be 12 years old and have a highlight reel, for coaches to educate that there's so much more to the game of basketball. And some of my favorite teammates and some of my most successful teams, expect, like when I think of the Caps from last season, when you look at our makeup compared to other teams' makeups, it was truly chemistry. And that is more than talent. And none of my teammates would take offense to that because we understood we needed each other the most to be successful. And that's when basketball is the most fun, in my opinion, compared to just rolling out five individual players. Because if you loved individual, you'd go play tennis or go play golf, which I can't stand. Because that gets so frustrated, but hopefully you'll like one day. But I think that's something, too, that is going to be an uphill battle for all junior coaches. Like the fact that now there's PlayHQ where you can figure out, you know, what you scored in domestic, you know, Div 7, you know, under 10s. But like, that's probably a dramatic example. But like, I think that's
just, that it is.
You know, I just think that's going to constantly be a battle that I never had to face that. So I actually feel sad for
some of the kids that that's now what they'll have to fight through. And that takes a really resilient, quiet, emotionally intelligent child to be able to say, you know what, I'm a really good team player, even though I only scored 2 points. You know, like,
yeah.
And I know adults who can't do that. So.
When we, I'll give you a little bit of info before this. When Zoe was first approached to jump on the Bendigo staff by Kennedy, like, and she was sort of went back and forth with it. Do I have time? Do I have the ability to get up there?
No.
Still do my job?
No.
Yeah. Yeah. We knew the answer, but we kept having the conversation regardless.
I tell you, I'm not missing the 4:45 wake up to get up there.
Nor I, as it turned out. But one of the driving reasons for why she said yes was actually yourself and Kelly Wilson. Like, she's like, this is nice. She's like, she works with junior athletes, obviously, and loves them and all that sort of stuff. But it was like, I remember her saying, it's nice to be able to work with just some old school vets that just come in, do stuff the right way. They lead, they're self-reliant, those types of things. And obviously you're a big part of that. How did you get to that point where you are that? Because I don't think it's something you're necessarily born with. I think it is something that you do develop over time. How can you still be doing that at 35, like still hungry to go and do that sort of stuff?
I think part of it's probably because, like, I never feel like I've arrived. Like, I think that's part of, like, playing with a chip on your shoulder, whether it is Opal's, you know, misselection, whether it is my WNBA career, like, I'm still processing, you know, what that could have been, what that's like, whether it's how I want to treat people. Like, a lot of it is relationships are really important to me, and how people feel being around me. And also, I think my number one rule in leadership is don't expect anyone to do anything you're not prepared to do yourself. So leading by example, you cannot be a vocal leader without leading by example. So it was great. No, it's done.
Mostly got to use this button all season. Great.
I was sitting next to Meg. I've got so much time for Meg. I was sitting next to Meg on one of our flights. And she just looks at me with the most sincerest of eyes and says, you just love training this much? I laughed and I said, Meg, it's not like I go to bed with my spirit singlet and shorts on and rip the covers off and say, yes, another day of training. You know, like, I don't, it's not this, like, oh, like, I can't wait to get there. I can't wait, you know, to lift weights. Like, that's not how I feel about it. But I think for me, it's become an expectation that I have of myself, and also know that that's how things, in my experience, to experience success, this is how things need to do, and you can do everything right and still not achieve the ultimate goal. But so I think that was just a really great moment for me to see how other people perceive my journey in my day-to-day versus the actual internal struggle that's happening when the alarm goes off. But I'd be remiss of me not to say that what I've found is I need at least one other person who understands, and that's where Kelly becomes instrumental in all of my successes. You look at any season that I've had that's had success, individual success, except for our second championship with the Caps, like, Kelly Wilson has been there, and it's because she gets it. And while people think, maybe perceive me to be a hard worker and do the hard work, Kelly's like a whole nother level, like another book. It's not even the same chapter. Like, what she's done her entire career, you know, is, and the narratives around her, whether it's undersized or unassuming or whatever it is, but you know, once you've played with her, you're better off for playing with her. But it's not just what she does on court, it's what she does off the court. And for her to do that while being a mom, while working still this season, it's like, yeah, I can probably show up. You know, like, I can definitely do this. So I think for me, what I found is I need at least one other person that gets it and trust that if you don't make it an obligation, and you show people that eventually people will understand. And I'll bring up Meg again. She said, oh, if those old ducks are doing it, we can probably do it too. Which I can joke about my age. I have no problem joking about Kelly, however, takes big offense to it. But it's great to kind of, and that's kind of, while it was a struggle, what was also exciting about this season with the Spirit, because it was all about building new habits, building new expectations, creating new standards about what professionalism can look like. And so no one sat me down and had a conversation. No one said, you know, this is how it has to be. But selfishly, I know if I'm in shape, if I'm strong, the game becomes easier too. So it's one of those things about do the work now and hopefully you'll be, you know, in a better position for it.
I think one of the things that was most impressive to me watching both you and Kelly operate within the group is there's a, and bear with me with this, once I say it, let me finish. There was no fear of not being liked. And what I mean by that is, you know, you and Kel would hold players accountable and yourselves just as accountable, you know, without that, oh, I'm going to be upset with me or, you know, because at the end of the day, we know the data tells us, everything tells us, peer-to-peer accountability and peer-led teams are more successful than coach-driven teams. So to be able to see that in the flesh, like, of, you know, not just the both of you holding the team accountable, but then holding each other accountable and holding yourselves accountable, I think that's where sometimes leaders might fall down, is they're happy to hold others accountable and that's fine, but when the shoe's on the other foot and it's time for them to put their hand up, sometimes that gets missed. And watching how both of you operate was just next level. It was, you know, if you wanted to, like you talk about the book, if you want to write a book on it, there it is right there. And I would encourage any coaches, you know, to try and, I know Bendigo can be a fair trek, but if you can get to practice and watch and just watch how, you know, these players go about it, is just what you'll learn to be able to then try and instill in our younger athletes would be, it's invaluable, you know, and it's something I've taken straight back to whether they like it or not, has come back, because I remember not long after getting involved, we had an MPP session. Oh, I've got a story. We had an MPP session at MSAC, and so, you know, we're doing our skill stuff, our competitive, you know, getting through that, and then we're in a particular activity, and I said, right, I'm not saying anything now. This is on you. So your job now is to coach each other. And we had a, you know, because we're playing, we're not running system, we're just running motion-based, concept-driven, trying to make good basketballers. And we had one of our best shooters come off a pin down, and the ball was delivered to her at her feet. And she caught it and she shot it, but she missed it. And I'm sitting there like, come on. Come on, Sam. And she didn't. And I said, so I stopped it and I said, do you have anything you need to, is there an instruction you need to give? And she goes, oh, I'm like, come on. and it's like dragging it out, but we eventually got there. And it was a case of, hey, she's not going to hate you for delivering that message. As long as you deliver it the right way, and as long as when it's your turn, you're willing to take it on yourself. And so then by the end of that session, now all of a sudden, I think we had 10 athletes there. I had 10 extra coaches now, this, you know, sort of talking to each other, and they're learning to not only deliver that feedback and be okay with it and feel comfortable within themselves doing it, also learning how to take it from a teammate as well, because if they want to progress, you know, I can only imagine some of the things that were said to you in the WNBA, like, and it's, you know, you can't be frightened. You can't, there's no time to get a fright with that stuff. Like, you've got to be able to take it and roll on.
Absolutely. And I think, it's important to be able to hear it and take it on board. It's also important to know when, they don't know what they're talking. Like, there's an important filter that needs to happen. And I think there's different levels of junior basketball, like where you're pulling it out of people. It's probably, all of it's probably pretty on board. Whereas I probably took too much on board in the WNBA, and lost who I was and what I did really well. And so it's kind of getting to know yourself. But when you're talking about that, it reminded me of a teammate that I played with, and she was really great at holding people accountable. But it created this sense of like fear almost in drills, like about like the ball not hitting the floor. Like that was a really big thing for her in college. And so she wanted into ours. And so we were doing team shooting, but it was so erratic because people were so worried about the rebounds. And like everyone was walking to the other end of the floor to go shoot at the other basket because they didn't want to be at her basket. And I remember just having a conversation with her. And I said, look, I said, you are spot on. Like we need to hustle after rebounds. What you are saying is so true. But if someone does it, you have to acknowledge it. Like, and so that's the thing with my leadership style when I'm trying to create an environment where I can give peer feedback. I don't want the only time that my teammates hear my voice to be when I'm being critical or holding them accountable. So I think it's all, and also building relationships. So I was a lot quieter earlier on in the season because for me, it's really important to build those foundations before I start having the more difficult conversations with people. So they genuinely know that my intent is for them to be better. Like I have no skin in the game for own progression or stepping over people to climb a ladder. It's all about what we need. And hopefully they can see my self-sacrifice so they can be aware of that. But you know, everyone's different in their journey and where they're going and how they're going to get there and what leadership style they like and what environments they like to play in. And, you know, I'm someone who, you know, are critical of Gauze and Kennedy because I don't think he holds us accountable enough. Like I want more hard, you know, rigid, like structure, like, you know, really clear. And it's probably goes back to, you know, being a college player and that being still in my mind, but not agreeing necessarily that that's the best way for it to happen. But that's been something that I really had to grow and learn to be okay in the chaos and be okay in players problem solving and then not being coaches stepping in. And it actually took a coach who micromanaged everything for me to be able to appreciate that getting comfortable in the uncomfortable on the court. So, yeah, it is one of those things. Peer feedback, I think, is so important. But I will say, as a captain and someone who's still playing, it helps so much when the coaches create the boundaries and then the player can then uphold, or it can be team created. So like Spirit, we created it as a group and Kennedy made sure that we were all on the same page about it. They weren't his standards. They were our standards as players. But when a coach, because what I find at times with teams is that there can be a separation between me and my peer group where I'm seen differently to my peers because of my leadership position. And so at times I struggle from a social standpoint because I'm not really a coach, but I have more responsibility than a player. And so I can struggle with that where I'm respected so much, but it's not so much of a peer-to-peer relationship at times, which I get sad about and it can feel a bit isolating. But I've also now gotten over that and realized that is my role in a team and that's what I need to do for our teams to be successful, which is nice to have another veteran like Kelly who's similar in that position. But for me, it's really great when a coach holds players accountable and then I can rise. Or there's that, I guess, kind of dichotomy where we're both able to work together. So it's not just coaches, but it's also not just players.
It's like being the oldest cousin. Like when you get to that age and you're not really at the kids' table and you're not really yet at the adults' table.
Exactly, exactly right.
There's all sorts of drama that comes with that, let me tell you. So from a player's perspective, what is the best advice you could give to a coach at this point? So, I mean, we're not trying to retire you early or anything like that, but from what you've experienced, like it's been a long career, what is the best advice you can give to a coach that maybe they don't get from like a coaching course or a coaching clinic, but just something that we probably take for granted a little bit?
I'm sure it's stuff. I'm sure, like Australia, I think, does a really good job in coaching education, and coaches seem to be quite generous in their time and support for one another. That's been my experience. Working at a community level, that it seems to be that coaches, I'll speak more towards the like WNBL, NBL one level, because whilst I've done some junior coaching, I probably can't speak enough to that, but it may translate across all levels. You guys would know better than I would because you've coached at all levels, but relationship building, relationship with your players is the most important thing. Like it's just like coaching and teaching. I think that's why I enjoy being a teacher so much. Is because of the mentoring that you get to do. You get to help people experience success. And it's really quite people think it's selfless. It's not quite selfish. I get joy in seeing people succeed, so it has nothing to do with their success. It has to do with the joy that it brings me. And so, but that can't happen, I don't think, if you don't have relationships. And I think meeting your players with where they're at. I think that with that, though, a relationship isn't, it's not a peer-to-peer relationship. I do think there has to be a hierarchy to teams and to coaching. And that's not to say a dictatorship by any means, but I think that sport is such an amazing way to give life skills to young people. And if we don't make sport challenging and we don't make it difficult and we don't provide adversity, then how are we really setting up these young people to be successful off the court and off of out in life? And so for me, if I was a coach, or if I were to coach, I would want to provide a lot of opportunities for failure so that kids know, young adults know, they can fail and they can actually learn more from that failure than they can from experiencing success. Because we have such an immediate gratification culture right now where people look like they've arrived, they look like they've done great, they look like they have it all. Talk a lot about social media, it's probably a whole other podcast.
Thank you to start.
And so while you have that hour of a training, or while you have that 2 hour, how long that session is a week, in a week, being able to provide as much real life problems, it's not even real life problems, because those are the real problems. You know, a turnover isn't a real problem. This life isn't a real problem. It feels like it. Catastrophizing, a sports psych helped me with catastrophizing. but I think being able to show how much can be learned in that, and that it isn't the end of the world, and that it actually makes you better, or how you respond to it can make you better. I think that's the most important thing that we can do in sport. And that doesn't happen with this cotton wool protection. And whilst that might seem cutthroat, that is what created who I am today. Now, my parents and family provided that. So it was not cutthroat in the car. It wasn't cutthroat in the car ride home. It wasn't cutthroat. I couldn't have even told you what my stats were in high school. I had no idea. You know, like that's not my parent. I mean, me and my dad joke about it now because my dad was a bit more stat driven when it came to my college career and things like that. But my mom would also drive me nuts when she'd be like, "But how do you feel?" And I'd be like, "Mom, just how do you think I feel?" You know, so you're probably gonna cop it, parents out there that have your feelings. You're probably gonna cop it, but know that in the long run, you're creating an emotionally intelligent athlete, which is so, so, so important. And I think the other thing, which this might not be so much a coaching thing as much as a parenting, or if you're looking at a whole athlete, is helping your child understand their passions, hobbies, love for things outside their sport as well. And like, as a coach, if you can identify that this is a hobby for that child, let it be a hobby. If it's a passion for that child, let it be a passion. I think too often you can get to, you know, my age or younger, and you are pursuing your parents' passion and not your own passion, and you can't figure out why you're so unhappy when you're experiencing success, or people say, you know, you've got it all or you've done all these things, but you aren't actually experiencing happiness, and it's because you're doing somebody else's dream, which can eventually turn into your kid's dream, or it can eventually turn into a passion or something your child really does enjoy doing. But I think educating kids that they can be very successful at sport and not be all about sport, because I certainly am. Aaron will be the first to tell you, I play my best basketball when my life is balanced. When I am all about basketball, I do not play good basketball. Hence the hub season.
Makes a lot of sense. So we've got a few couple of quick questions just to hit you with, yeah. And then two important ones towards the end. Top five teammates.
Five, man.
Kelly Wilson, we'll give you the first.
Yeah, Kelly Wilson, Gabe Richards, Chelsea O'Bree. Mary Anatolo.
It's a good team already.
Yeah. I think coaching effort.
Yeah.
This is a tough one. Gosh, I can't whittle it down to five.
You can have two if you want.
Yeah, make it six.
Yeah. You may have to come off the bench though in this group.
Hey, Zona will be the first to tell you, I am all for being six man. I have no problem with that. Just make sure that I'm in the last 2 minutes of the game. We could have a whole podcast about starters and my despise for what is the pedestal that is to be a starter. All right, I'm going to have to explain these. I think all of those four are pretty self-explanatory. Some more that I want to talk about. Kia Nurse. So Kia Nurse came out here, could have been the biggest diva, had every right to. Jordan athlete, UConn, national championship, you know, WNBA player. She just came in and listened and never shied away from the big moment. Like, that is some, and was unapologetically her and was a competitor. Like, I think when I look at, like, I'd like to name another, like, five players, it all comes down to how they competed. You know, another one, Keely Follin. Follins can be very polarizing, and I understand that. I understand that. There'd be people who are listening to this podcast that would probably be like, what? Now, let me tell you, Keely is someone who, like, I'll never forget this game we played against Melbourne in Canberra. She got smacked in the face by Sophie Cunningham. I remember that. Demolished her nose. Like, she looked like Squidward. Her nose was, like, so flat on her face. Had an orbital fracture. Didn't know it at the time. Wrapped her face up, went down, hit the baseline jumper to have the go-ahead to win that game, which was really important in the standing of things. Like, ultimate competitor. And was, you know, still probably does have a little bit of a hard head. And when she was young, I got to know her when she was really young. And so she had a lot of life lessons that she still needed to learn as an athlete. But now to see her grow into a leader and what she's doing in Sydney and how she's handled the unfortunate adversity that's had to go on in the club this season, for me, makes me such a proud, you know, proud person to call her a friend. And so I think, like, for me, and getting to see that growth and development of her career would be, you know, very soft. But, like, her how competitive she is and her want to win, it can't go without being mentioned. But then it's so hard because, like, your teammates are what make, you know, your career. And when you play for five isn't fair, because when you play for as long as I've played, there's so many amazing people. Because I could say Kylie McLaren came out here. She was an import my first year with Canberra. She was expecting to play big minutes, like all imports do. She had a really bad knee injury, but because she was such a great teammate, we kept her, even though she was never going to play a minute. And she was the glue. She was the glue between the bench and the star. And, like, glue players, that could be another podcast. Like, that is why Townsville is doing what Townsville's done in the win streak down is because of their glue. It's not because of their studs. Because studs do what studs do all the time. That's why they get paid what they get paid. Championship teams have glue. Townsville has a lot of glue. Whether they win or not, we'll see how that ages in this podcast. But that's what, if I'm a coach and I'm recruiting glue. Because you'll get your production from your studs. It's what they get paid to do. Anyways, I can keep going down the line. Hopefully I haven't upset anyone. I'm sure there's
That's okay. It's you for the thing, Zoe, to listen to this podcast anyway. So it's all right. That's just too much of that. Exactly right. So a couple of would you rathers.
Okay.
Would you rather have a pickup training session where you just scrimmage and just see what happens, or would you rather do drill work?
If I have a team full of vets, pickup.
No one's getting in there anyone's face.
Yeah. If it's high quality basketball, like, I think that's probably what I've appreciated about my last kind of 6 years of playing and 5 years of playing with Gauze and Kennedy, is that there's foundational drill work, but there's a lot of scrimmage, because you need to be able to play, to problem solve, to figure out, to see how defense, because as much as you'd like it, games are messy, and drill work, whilst it's great in breakdown, I know that you guys can definitely appreciate what you do in a drill really translates to a game.
Very true.
So I would say I think scrimmage is very important, but scrimmage with boundaries, scrimmage with, you know, emphasis, I think is important.
Yep. Post-game, ice bath or massage?
Oh, massage.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I would have a massage every day if I could.
Sound like Zoe. Difference is she's not playing anymore. And she's full, like, every day.
Yeah. No niggles.
Yeah. Okay. Would you rather a day off or a shooting session?
Shooting session.
Yeah.
Easy. I can't stop. If I stop, then I realize how sore and hurt I am to just keep going. Like, yeah, and I think that's part of, you know, like, people probably look at Kelly and I and just think we're demented, but it's actually like, it's out of necessity, not out of trying to prove a point. Or at least for me, it certainly is. Like, I feel better moving, you know, if I sit too long, it's not good.
Yep. Would you rather coach under 16 athletes or under 18 athletes?
Because we have both. To be honest, I coached an under 18s team at Radford when I was the head of their basketball program. And I really enjoy that age group. Even more so, I think, like, college, I think college coaching would probably be my, like, perfect age group, if an age group exists. However, putting my livelihood in the hands of people who are identifying who they are as people and trying to think they're adults, even though they haven't figured out half of the things that happen in life, is a bit scary. But I think, yeah, under 18, I really enjoyed it. But it was, again, going back to, like, it was great. We had this session and this girl was crying and she had no confidence. And so we got to talk about confidence and where you get confidence from. And I said, who gives you your confidence? We went on the circle and I knew the answer. Without fail. Oh, you know, like you do, my teammates, support. Oh, I said, absolutely not. No way does anyone have control over your confidence. You get it from doing the work, from coming to training, from seeing the ball go in, from knowing that you deserve great things. Even though you might not have get those great things, you deserve it because you did the work. That's where you get your confidence. So I think that's been really fun for me, especially with young women, getting to help that, because I hope that carries over into other areas of their life where they're so hypercritical of themselves. But I also really enjoy coaching young men as well, because it's the complete opposite. It's like pulling them back. It's like, oh, you're Steph Curry? Okay, let's see how many threes you make. Let's do five spot shooting. How many threes do you actually? Okay, well, maybe we would pass up that shot next time.
Reality checks are part of coaching.
Instead of all of that, I got 8 ins.
Well, and the reason we asked, like we have mentioned before, Kelsey has been on the pod before, and we did ask a question around, you know, what do you want to do? And you know, just the...
I'd love to move back to Bendigo and really be a part of that program, or any program really, where I can help, especially country kids. I'm a bit biased. I really do like country kids. To be able to, yeah, do some coaching and leadership and just that those skills, I think, are so important, because I look back at my college career and my coach was all about helping create better people than when they came into the program. So we had so many community service hours that we had to do in schools. We had to have a certain GPA, and then obviously she wanted us to be successful on the court. And so I think those are things that I really appreciate that she instilled in me, and those are things that I would love to give back to Bendigo and Greater Victoria.
Now I know I'm here. There's a good stitch up. I was invited back. It was a setup. I've been set up.
Oh, look, we've opened about 14 Swiss bank accounts in your name, like with audiograph, all that sort of stuff at the moment.
I'm taking that as an application. I'm taking that.
That's great. That is fantastic.
No, it's... I mean, we obviously don't want to retire you or anything like that. Play as long as you can potentially play more than anything else. But I mean, the last question, which is probably a more serious take on this, is what do you think the women's game needs to do to become more prominent in Australia in particular? Like, where would you like to see it go? How would it look for you, whether you're still playing or not at that stage? Like, I hope you can play until you're 54 or something like that if you want to. But what do you think needs to be done to really get it front of mind?
Good question.
There you go.
First of all, I'm really happy that some of that, all of that still really rings true. So it is kind of, I appreciate that grab that you guys played. That's pretty awesome. I think basketball, without being too dire, I think is really at a crossroads with AFLW. I've spoken with a couple AFLW players about what their CBA is going to look like over the next, you know, into 2026. And when we're talking about legitimate career pathways, so if we're talking about that side of sport, because there's a whole community side of sport, but if we're talking about, you know, putting basketball on the forefront, I'm going to assume that to mean like professionalism and broadcast and coverage and respect and all of that. Basketball has its work cut out for it. You know, opportunities, there's more positions in a football team. There are currently more football teams than there are WNBL teams. And so I think that there has to be great governance. I think that there needs to be real clarity and transparency about the strategic plan for basketball. I am not a business person, so I will not put even any ideas out there to how you make it into a business, because I don't know that. I'll speak to things that I feel comfortable and educated on. That's not something that I really understand nor have a desire to get to understand. But I think that there has to be a plan, and it has to be different to what netball and football are doing, because it is a competitive space. And cricket. You look at the contracts and what was happening in cricket with their draft that they just had. And so if we're talking about legitimate career opportunities, there's a lot of competition, which is great for women. You know, great for women, sad for basketball. Unless there can be something put in place that makes this a career opportunity. Now, there are other things like Olympic medals that can be achieved in different ways to represent your country, and there's a whole other side to it. But I think for me, there needs to be a really clear plan for how that looks, and not just season to season, but longevity, 10 years down the track. Where are we wanting to be with Brisbane Olympics coming up? What are we wanting that lead up to look like for the WNBL, for NBL One, for our pathways? And so I think that's where the biggest, for me, that's where I think the biggest hurdle is and the biggest thing that needs to be overcome. Because if, and I don't have to tell you guys, junior basketball is thriving, but that's in large part, I think, to the NBA. Now, it's sad at times when you go to a game and you see young girls wearing NBA players' singlets. But also, the WNBA is making strides. Nneka Ogunike and what she's been able to do in the Players Association and push for the contracts that those players are playing for, you know, it's definitely grown. The respect that the WNBA is getting has grown. EuroLeague, I think, has always been EuroLeague. I haven't played over there, really paid much attention as far as how they're going. But I think a lot of times in players, we get caught up in salaries and making money and earning potential. But for me, I think it's actually infrastructure. I think it's how do you build a professional league through professional employment within that league that looks like your operations side of things, that looks like your media, your marketing, your social media, whatever that is. And again, that's company and business that I don't understand, but there are a lot of really successful business people here in Australia who have done that. That I think is where women's basketball needs to grow the biggest. I wouldn't say it's necessarily in earning. I think that comes later when the league's actually in a place, because it's a thriving business, that then we can subsidize income because there's the money there to do it and there's the longevity there to do it, not just because players want to make more money. Whilst, yes, all players want to make more money, of course, and there's going to be competing salaries in other areas where young girls and families are going to have to decide which pathway they want to go. I think that sports specialization should not be a thing. You should play as many sports as you want. But I also think that it's something that basketball in Australia really needs to get on top of, because I think, yeah, come 2026, even before probably, the AFLW is just going to be, from a playing perspective, from a player earning potential perspective, really competitive. Yeah, not hard to catch up to.
Makes a lot of sense. I love the passion she speaks with this. Like, plays the whole, I don't know the answers. I kind of feel like she might. Overall, it's been just phenomenal, in all honesty, on my end, just to listen to you. Like, this was a lot of fun for me personally. Zoe's pretty happy because she didn't have to listen to me speak for like an hour and 17 minutes as well. So she's grateful for you coming. But honestly, just thank you so much for coming in today. I know you're very much in off-season mode and dealing with injuries and rehab and all that sort of stuff, but legitimately great fun talking to you about everything basketball related.
No, it's been an absolute blast, and I can't wait to see what I've set myself up for in 5 years' time for the number 3 Victorian job that I have to sign up for, because I've pigeonholed myself into it from this interview. No, it's been great, guys. I really appreciate what you guys do, and yeah, I'm happy to come back anytime.
Oh, don't open that door. Boy, it's, we might come to you next time. There we go. That might be the offset there. But again, thank you so much for jumping in. Thank you, Zoe, obviously, for getting all this set up. And thanks, Aaron, for dobbing you in for it as well, which is
MVP. I think it came about was Aaron and I were talking about food via Insta, and then that's pretty
much it. We've ended up on the podcast.
Yeah, anyone who's recruited me knows you don't recruit me, you recruit my wife. So smart ones are well ahead of the game.
Excellent. Coaches, thanks very much for listening. Hopefully a lot of players have listened to this too, because I think there's a lot of fantastic takeaways for athletes, male, female, young, old, doesn't really matter. There's a lot of stuff I think that a lot of people can take away from just this chat in general. So, Kelsey, good luck with the rehab. Good luck for next season. Obviously, go Bendigo on my end as well. But thank you very much, and best of luck for everything in the future.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for sticking with us on that one, coaches. Again, apologies to both Kelsey and the listeners out there for the audio quality on that one. Still don't know what happened, but unfortunately, it just wasn't the same standard we would usually like to produce. But we have managed to rectify whatever went wrong since, and it should be all good from here on out. Just one last thing before we let you go. We do want to make sure that, coaches, if you do want to thank any of your coaches out there for National Volunteer Week, so that might be players and parents that are looking to thank a coach, it might be coaching directors that are looking to thank their coaches, someone that's been a great mentor to you, someone like that, there is National Volunteer Week coming up from the 15th to 21st of May this year. So if there is anyone that you want to thank, we know a lot of coaches give up a lot of their time and energy and effort and you know, downtime in particular, I suppose, to go and coach so many people out there. So if there are any listeners out there that want to give a shout out in the way of a voice recording or something written, you can send it to us and we'll play it on the podcast this week. So if it's written, you just get the dulcet tones of myself reading it out for you. If it's something that's audio related, no problems at all. We'll just play that straight on there. So if there is anyone you'd like to give a shout out to for National Volunteer Week, let us know. Other than that, we'll catch everyone next week on the podcast.